Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with debut novelist Joe Bond. His new book is Hope House. To say that Joe Bond's first book is unusual is to say the least. It is a work of tragedy and comedy, heartbreaking genius, a story of lost boys and the man who tries to save them in a group home called Hope House in eastern Kentucky. This is a story that Joe Bond knows by heart. His father was committed to working with troubled boys, and Joe often found himself in charge of boys older than he was. This has given him great stories to tell, a brilliant insight into human nature, and a big-hearted outlook on life. Joe Bond, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, if you don't mind, I'd love for us to begin at the beginning. So if you'd read from the very opening of Hope House.
Sure. 9 more months. There were 10 of us, teenage boys with our heads shaved down to our scalps. Every morning we were up before the sun, the group in my face, telling me to get my bed made. Get in line. I'd forget to say okay, and peers were on me, wanting to know who I thought I was. The answer was nobody. I ain't nobody. I was the one they called AWOL. I was 14 years old. At night, I hid my shoes under my bunk. I listened for snores. The first time I ran, I crept down the back stairs, cut through the kitchen, and took off. Outside, the only sounds were night. My state-issued slip-on skippies throwing gravel back behind me and the thump of my heart punching against the walls of my chest. I can't describe what it was like to be that young, believing I could be free if I ran fast enough. The world was just down the hill, a winding quarter mile, walls of pine rising on my right and left, silhouetted against the stars, and the old house behind me, shadowed under the moon, fading into the dark. Soon enough, Mr. Watts would be out looking for me. That time and all the other times I ran, he would find me and take me back. Hope was supposed to be a 9-month program. When you ran, you started over. You lost your phase, your cigarettes. The group would meet me at the door with a yellow shirt, back to orientation. Come morning, it was out to the woodpile to bust wood, or else I was down in the kitchen on KP again. All day long, peers wanting to know why I kept messing over myself. 9 more months you got now. What is wrong with you? I don't know. You ain't ever getting out of here, they tell me. You ain't ever going home.
Wow. So what was it like for you to grow up with this as a counterbalance to your family life?
It was part and parcel. There really wasn't much separation. Uh-huh. You know, I spent enormous time. My dad worked all the time, and I went to work with him. So I was just always around the boys from my earliest memory. And none of it, because I had always known that, none of it was odd to me. To see, to be around group counseling, to hear the things the kids had gone through, that was just part of my childhood.
But that could go either way for you. It could make you either really generous, or it can make you really jealous, perhaps, mm-hmm. that you had a father who spent so much time with the other kids?
Yeah, I think that it changed completely my way of seeing the world compared to the kids around me, because I grew up in eastern Kentucky, so we had a pretty homogenous school, and everyone was pretty much the same. And then I also had all these boys I was around that had came from different cities and came from other parts of the state and had lived completely different lives. And I heard their stories, and it just expanded my worldview from the time I was 5 years old or even younger.
Is that when you started going to work with him?
I've told a story where I definitely remember being in my dad's office. Like, he would go have group counseling with the boys, and I would play in his office, and I had some toy cars. And I remember one day the door kicking open, and a kid came in, and he was screaming and crying, and the staff were trying to get control of him. They had him in the floor beside me, and my reaction was to scoot my cars back a little bit and to keep playing, because that was just the world I knew.
But at times, you were in charge of groups when you were older, right?
That's right. I started working at the one home when I was in high school, and I would go down on weekends and work midnight shift, and later, I would work the floor, like in college, in summers. I had a group to myself. Freshman year of college, I did that and would work. Like, my dad believed everyone should work all the time. It should be your life. And so I would work in summers, 60-hour weeks, and just, you know, was going to be him. He wanted me to be, like, a counselor and stuff, too.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I had the same drive to do that. You know, he had this big wound. He'd never had a father. And I'd had a pretty good one, you know.
You did.
Yeah.
How did he get into this line of work?
He studied sociology in college. He went to a small state school in Kentucky, Morehead State. And he was studying sociology and did like a practicum at a boys' home. I don't think he really liked sociology. I think he'd been doing accounting or something too and had no idea really what he wanted to do. And walked into the boys' home and saw these kids and how sophisticated they were, how sharp, even though they'd been in trouble, how intelligent, and thought, I could have been one of these kids. You know, he just connected with them. And that was going to be his life. He figured it out right then.
One of the things that struck me is how many lessons in masculinity there are in this book. It made me think of A Lesson Before Dying, mm-hmm. How to Be a Man.
Right.
Who teaches you how to be a man? Right. Who are those grown-ups in your life?
There's Ed Burns, who did The Wire with David Simon. I read an interview with him one time. It was a great quote. He said, the kids are going to get an education, okay? The question is where they're going to get it from. And he was talking about kids in Baltimore on the street. But it was in 1980s, 90s Kentucky where this book is set. It was the same thing. A lot of these boys, they had no idea who their fathers were. Their mothers had major issues as well. So it's who's teaching these kids. And they were learning how to live on the street. And when you view their mistakes in that context, it makes sense suddenly.
Perfectly.
When you take a kid home and see what he came from, it makes sense.
So tell us about some of the boys, because they're such memorable characters.
So, you know, one of my favorite characters in the book is Carvel McLemore. He's really the sharpest kid, and he understands his situation. You know, he knows he really doesn't have much of a chance. He knows what he's up against. And unlike some of the other boys, he can put words to that. Mm-hmm. He doesn't trust anyone because he's been through other programs. And, you know, that he's not like a thinly veiled character, but I knew so many kids like him that they were not going to trust. It could take months before they really start to tell you their story and who they got at home and what they've been through. So I loved to write him as a character. Bobby Church is a kid that in the book really was more like the kids I grew up with in Eastern Kentucky than just a boy at the home.
If you're just joining us, my guest is debut novelist Joe Bond, the author of Hope House. The humor in this book is so surprising.
That to me was vital because you have so much trauma and there's all these difficult things these kids have been through. But in real life, working with them, we laughed. I mean, it has to be funny. Otherwise, it's just really dark and it's too heavy for anyone. There were funny things happen all the time. The kids were really, they were hilarious. The staff, the people I worked with when I got older were probably goofier than the kids. Absolutely did the nuttiest stuff. But the kids, you had to be able to laugh with them and joke with them and connect with them in a fully human way. It couldn't be, I'm gonna go in here and be this kid's father figure. It did not work like that. They didn't trust you. You had to be a full human being, and you had to show up every day. You had to bring consistency and give them credit for their humanity.
Well, you certainly did. Has your dad read the book?
I would send him, a chapter at a time, and from when it first started his stories. And he would tell me, he would read and tell me who my characters really were, which we would kind of jokingly argue about. He would say, no, that's not exactly what happened, in real life. There's a moment in the book where the group pitches in. D'Amico Sears in the book has a son, he has a child. And the group pitches in and buys his child some clothes because D'Amico can't provide for him. Yeah. And they pull their money. And I thought I had imagined that. And my dad read that chapter and told me, you got that wrong. And I'm like, how could my imagination be wrong?
Yeah.
And he said it wasn't that. He said that really happened, but they didn't buy his clothes. They bought diapers. Then I started to remember something like that did happen. It wasn't a kid named D'Amico, it was a different kid, but it was a group of, so-called delinquents who had all committed crimes, and they got to know this kid and he became one of them, and they found a way to get some money together, the little bit they could have, and buy his kid some diapers, sent diapers home.
And the thing is, he knew what a father was supposed to do and be. And he had an imaginary ideal of a father in his mind. And that's what's so heartbreaking. Yeah. Everything conspires against him all the way through.
The instinct is there. And that, I think, is kind of a core part of the book, is the instinct is still there in these kids. They've done a lot of stuff. They've been through a lot, but they're still human beings. Now, someone like Carvel, you see him do cruel things, get some of the other kids to run off. But that is also the challenge of the job for someone like Mr. Watts, is to find that humanity where other people have given up on them. And if you can find it and connect with the kid, then maybe you give him a chance in life.
So the thing that breaks your heart as you watch these kids is that the outside world doesn't offer them much of a chance. Right. They're always on this razor's edge of, if I run, what do I run to? If I stay here, at least I have this. So it's really a razor's edge that they're existing on most of the time.
A lot of that came from my real life experience. And, my dad had a little bit of a different view on treatment. He really believed instead of putting the kids in the home and isolating them, you had to keep them connected to the world. And so he would push for the boys to get to go to public school.
Right.
He would push for them to have jobs, stay connected to community. And with that came a lot, they made mistakes. If you take a kid from Louisville and put him in public school in Eastern Kentucky, it's two different worlds. Right. But he was determined to give him the chance to do that. So we constantly had backlash from the community. People were totally fine with the boys mowing their grass and doing all these small jobs, but didn't really want the boys going to school with their own kids. We ran into that constantly, and the boys would run into that when they went home.
And the other thing that's so interesting is the idea of mutual accountability with these characters and their stories, and how rigorously they attended to them. And, when somebody was waffling or prevaricating, they would go, speak up.
Right.
So talk a little bit about that hold the feet to the fire.
Right. So that was a type of treatment that was popular, especially in the 80s, 90s, where the idea was that the boys as peers had more influence on each other than the adults had on them. And there's really something to that. And in a bad home, though, that culture can get out of control to where the kids really use it to brutalize each other. And you see that some in the book. They can manipulate this group structure, holding each other accountable to sort of torture each other at times. Mm-hmm. But also there is, when the culture's right, it can have a positive influence on these kids. And someone like Carvel, when he finally buys in, can have way more weight on another character like Jaquan. These other kids who've been through the same things, they have way more influence on each other than the adult does. They can connect more directly. They've lived some of the same stuff. They've been through it. They're still up against the same things. So when they tell their stories and hear each other's stories, it just means that much more.
If you're just joining us, my guest is debut novelist Jo Bond, the author of Hope House. I love all the levels of meaning that this story has to do with what we show kids, mm-hmm. you know, and the fact that Mr. Watts brings his kids to work mm-hmm. says something to those boys, too.
Sure.
What was that like? Did you make friends? Did you?
I did everything with the boys. And so some of them were like, you know, a big brother to me. And I'll tell you a story. My sister's 2 years older than me. And one time my dad had us both with the boys and he was coaching them in softball. And again, that was his life. And so there was no other staff there. So it was just him and me and my sister and the boys. And we had a bad accident. My sister, we were crossing the road with the boys after practice, and she ran across. She pulled her hand out of my dad's hand and ran across the road and got hit. And, you know, we all thought she was dead. I was probably 5 or 6 years old. And she got hit by a truck and went flying. And my dad, of course, ran to her. And all of us thought she's like, here, the death of a child right here in front of us. And I don't remember the kid. But one of the boys had no supervision at that point because my dad's in the street with my sister. And so they could have run off. They could have done anything they wanted. And one of the kids grabbed me because I'm standing there and I see my sister in the street. He grabs me and runs me back in the park and just turns me away from it. So I can't see my sister lying there in the street.
Wow.
That's what that kid did for me. You know, he knew whatever he'd done to be in a home, whatever he'd been through, that was in his heart. Like he could see that moment and know like this kid's big sister just got ran over.
Yeah.
And I don't want him to watch this.
And it's going to ripple through your life.
Yeah. So he got me away. My dad still remembers the kid. His name was Chris. I don't know his last name, but that was his impulse in that moment, not to stare, but to get me away. And so, I mean, I love the boys, especially when I was really little. And later when I worked with them in the summers, you know, they you just get to know them and they mean so much to you. It's hard. When you lose one, you know, the boys would go home and it was real life and kids would get killed and some of them would make it. They'd email you years later and that was enough to kind of think that you helped in the ways that you could.
So it seems to me you couldn't be anything but a writer growing up in an environment like that because storytelling was a part of the ritual of every day, mm-hmm. you know, and even the outlines of different types of stories, mm-hmm. the rigorous honesty, mm-hmm. all of that. So when did you commit to writing? When did you know this was going to be your life?
Well, it was not encouraged in Eastern Kentucky. I would say that. I did have teachers who loved books, and that was important. There were people who cared about literature, but it was never going to be what I did. I wrote a boys' home story in eighth grade. It was the first one I wrote about a kid named Chance that I had imagined. And they had me go and read it to, you know, the whole eighth grade or seventh grade. The kids younger than us. But that was kind of it. It wasn't really encouraged. I mean, I was clearly knocking at the door. Like it was something I had in me, but I was going to run a boys' home. I was going to do what my dad did. And I would say in college, you know, the home I was working at closed. They were always closing. Things were always happening and they were getting They would close and life would move on. And that kind of gave me the freedom after I'd graduated college. There was no home to work in. And so I had been doing journalism and writing some. And my wife was in grad school at Kentucky. She was in nursing school. And she was the one who said, well, if you really want to write, just take some English classes and go from there. And then all of a sudden I discovered people like Richard Ford and Raymond Carver and Dennis Johnson. And just, I had never read that much growing up. I was in my 20s at that point and discovered all of that stuff and you know, instantly started doing my imitations of them, as young writers do.
Yeah.
Then spent the, you know, the next decade or however long writing about the wrong stuff. Never even thought about writing about the boys until I was a father. I had a son and started thinking about fatherhood more and remembered all those boys that I'd known. And that whole world, the world in this book, came rushing back like it had never gone away.
Did you study creative writing?
I took a few workshops. I took a workshop at Kentucky undergrad with Kim Edwards, mm-hmm. Who is a great writer. And she was the one who wrote me a note about reading Richard Ford and Richard Yates. And I took a nonfiction workshop with Eric Reese, who's a great writer. And I had a professor, Tom Marksberry, who taught American Lit and just had us read a survey of everybody. And that was the best thing for me because in one summer, I just made this massive discovery.
If you're just joining us, my guest is debut novelist Joe Bond, the author of Hope House. I wonder if you'd read one more little bit for us. There's so many beautiful sections. This is really hard to choose.
Oh, thank you. That's why I was like, I'll let you choose. We ran when it got old. When we blinked our eyes and saw it all anew. A pack of delinquent teenagers living together in an old house. It was nuts. We ran when we couldn't make it another day, but also when we were doing well, when doing well terrified us. What is wrong with you, AWOL? You had it. I ran out of habit, out of necessity. I ran to see if anyone could find me, to see if anyone would look. Here's the thing, Watts told me. When you run, and they don't know where they're going. This was true. I'd go AWOL, and a day or two later, a peer on orientation would take off next. No clue which direction to set off in. Too eager to grab a pair of long pants or even a coat before he bolted out the door into the woods. I was going to get a peer hurt, Watts warned me. They'll close us down, he said. I swear to God, they'll close us down. But I kept running. I needed to know if he was going to get rid of me. I was sure that one day he would, that I would do something and he would have to. But I never stole a car. I never broke into a house. I'd see some of the world was all, see it on my own, then wait on him to come get me and take me back. At Hope, we were capable of cruelty, of pettiness and bullying, but also we believed it when Watts told us that our lives were in each other's hands. The same peers telling you that you were going to lose that hitch in your step were the ones who'd loan you a decent pair of shoes and a shirt on a Sunday because your mom might visit. The same peers who swore they'd never forgive you for stealing their money were the ones who'd pick you up in group after you'd broken down and told them something real. That was what it was like when the group was running right, when it would have been a bald-faced lie. We'd have pointed out a problem if anybody had told us we didn't have someone. We had each other. But still, there was so much to run from. We ran from our past, but also our futures. We ran when it was time to go home and our workers couldn't find us a placement. When step-down programs and halfway houses filled their last openings. When our grandmothers died and our aunts and uncles had their phones shut off or otherwise lost contact. However far we made it, Watts would find us and bust us back down to orientation. 9 more months. But you knew and he knew it was just a way to keep you a little bit longer. There were peers at Hope who didn't care for the place, but some of us needed it. We ran because we had nowhere else to go. We ran so we could stay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Joe Bond, whose unforgettable first book is Hope House. Put it at the very top of your must-read list. Joe, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Here's what's on tap this week in the literary life. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Memory Piece by Lisa Coe, Saturday, June 20th at 10:30 a.m. at Octavia Books. Marita Crandall signs the first two books in her Mosquito Southern Vampire series, Monday, June 22nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. Kathy Chapetta Spies will discuss and sign her new book, The Faith of New Orleans, at 7 p.m. Tuesday, June 23rd at East Bank Regional Library. Tia Williams discusses and signs The Mist Connection, Thursday, June 25th at Baldwin & Company. Doors open at 5, event begins at 6. This is a ticketed event.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.